C-3PO gets shut down. Sean Connery saves Alcatraz, and Pixar drives us crazy this week in 302010. 302010, here we go again. Analyzing decades, sitting with our friends, those with different days. And there's so much to say. I wish I had a better way to intro the show than welcome everyone. I'm so sick of that.
It's your trademark.
If you listen back years, I seem to start every show I've ever been on with that, and I'm waiting for the montage of welcome, 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 welcome. It's bad. But this is your weekly look back at what happened in pop culture, movies, music, TV, and games 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago.
Some boring news, maybe.
Occasionally some boring news.
This week in general.
Yeah.
I think Reagan had polyps in his colon. That's about
Jesus.
It.
This is the week June 3rd through the 9th, just in the start of summer. But I'm one of your hosts, Brett Elston.
Christopher Antista.
Henry 3PO Gilbert.
Boo.
Yeah, that's bad.
Die 2D2.
Yeah,
that's better. That's much better.
Or Diana Goodman.
That's
the internet. I'm plugging you. I'm just plugging you.
Thank you.
We usually start in 86, and movies is usually what brings us into the show. And we have a one of the lesser known Arnold vehicles.
This is the only Arnold movie I've never seen.
This must be what they mean by poetic justice.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Nobody gives Schwarzenegger a raw deal.
Oh, I love you, Don LaFontaine. Also, take note there, I've never heard the music used officially elsewhere. That's the music from The Warriors in that trailer. Yeah. I kept thinking it was a fan edit, but it's the real trailer.
Wow. Raw deal. Arnold movie that's like released the week after Cobra, or like a couple weeks after Cobra. We just talked about Stallone.
You pointed their posters look exactly the same, and
I think it's very similar.
It's hard to imagine. It's hard to remember Stallone and Schwarzenegger warring at the box office because they can pretty much barely succeed when they combine themselves together at this point. But yeah, that was the case. It was a give and take. Who's better, Stallone or Schwarzenegger?
Yeah.
And then Bruce Willis like shoved in there like, I can be here too, guys.
Yeah.
Skibbity bop doo.
The note that's on the wiki for this, and I saw this as a kid. I have no memory of it at all.
It's not
Predator. It's not even Commando. It's just another movie that
doesn't
he's
even
in.
Have a Belushi in it, so it's not memorable in that way.
I've seen Red Heat.
But the thing I thought was interesting note about this on the wiki is that the film was originally produced so that Dino De Laurentiis.
De Laurentiis.
Thank you, Diana.
When nobody cry when Godzilla die. When Kong die, everybody cry.
I cried in Godzilla.
One of the famous, not totally schlock producers, but...
Yeah. Well, he's a schlock producer, but he also imported all of Fellini's films to the U.S.
I just love...
A wonderfully notable character in the history of cinema.
I just love those, like, emphatic Italian, or just, like, his Mediterranean style. Just like, I spend the money, I make it look crazy.
Yeah, I love a foreigner coming in and working in Hollywood because their frankness. Yeah, it needs a bigger bang.
That's what I loved in the Canon film stock we talk about on here all the time, of just those two Israeli guys.
Hurry, make film.
Everyone talk about making film. We make film. We do it.
But the story on this was like, this movie was produced originally so he could inject money into a long gestating project, Total Recall.
Total Recall.
That he owned the rights for, and one that Schwarzenegger would later take the leading role. Partly due to the poor box office performance of Raw Deal, Laurinaitis would eventually file for bankruptcy.
Oh.
And the rights to Total Recall were sold to Carolco.
Henry now?
I'm reading how they're pronounced. I don't know these arcane companies from 50 million years ago.
These are particularly fascinating companies.
Yeah, so. I mean, I watched the Electric Boogaloo documentary, but I didn't commit the names.
Wonderfully, but like that company, De Laurentiis and Carlico just imploded big time on themselves.
Yeah. Well, Carlico, I know them because they had the Spider-Man rights at one
time. Terminator.
But the conclusion to this is at the time, Schwarzenegger was still under contract for a number of Conan movies. In exchange for dissolving that agreement, Schwarzenegger agreed to star in Raw Deal.
Wow.
So it's a weird mishmash of reasoning why this...
So that film exists so he wouldn't have to do more Conans. It's like, wow.
So what does he play in this? Is he a cop?
I couldn't figure it out. I really could. He plays three different people.
He is Mark Kaminsky / Joseph P. Brenner.
Yeah.
Okay.
In a movie about shooting people, let's say.
I'm going to guess this is one of those when they never address that he's got an accent.
Yeah. But has like the most
totally
Anglo name
it,
of all time.
They just totally take it for granted that, oh, ever since I grew up in Baltimore.
I'm Ben Rich is from Des Moines, Iowa.
At the hard streets of Chicago, we have a saying.
Just that David Cross thing. I was born in El Paso, Texas. What are you talking about? I've always lived here.
No, I bet De Laurentiis wouldn't have made as good. He wouldn't have produced as good a Total Recall film. Like, you need Paul Verhoeven to be crazy and sexy. Yeah, a foreigner who makes American
films. Give Cameron all the credit for Terminators, not Schwarzenegger. Total Recall is Schwarzenegger's best film, period. It's great. Wow. He's great in it. He does a great job.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I love Paul Verhoeven so much.
Top Gun was number one this week.
What?
Oscillating back and forth with Cobra. We've talked about both of these movies in prior episodes. So if this is somehow your first, go back for a...
So rad.
Both of them great films for their own reasons. Invaders from Mars also came out this week.
Yes.
I don't know. It's a remake.
It's Tobey Hooper again, though.
Oh, yeah. That's in the Electric Boogaloo doc as well.
Yeah.
It is
really
ridiculous
cool.
looking. Like,
they
want to make like a Twilight Zone.
It's in the
movie.
Canon Films documentary, and like they're talking about when they screened it for the Golem Globus people, and they thought it was a different film.
They were screening the Sharon Stone, Alan
whatever the Indiana Jones ripoff.
Alan Quatermain and King Solomon's Mines.
Yeah, they gave the wrong notes to the wrong film and had them implemented because they worked that
you
fast.
You got to give us the monster.
This is supposed to be our romance. There's monsters everywhere. You're watching Invaders from Mars. Shut up! I know my job. And like,
wow.
And it's this movie looks really cool. I also like it made me want to do a little article. We get a lot of flack for seeming out of touch. If you're complaining about remakes, you're out of touch. Because this was during the period when all these 1950s movies were being remade. The Thing, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Invaders from Mars.
By the dorks who grew up with them.
It's always happened.
Are you telling me my generation's not unique?
You're just not the first. And I feel like every young person needs to hear that.
Yeah. But Hooper, it's important to know. Hooper had just made Life Force, which was about nude vampires
fucking great.
Eating people.
With Patrick Stewart.
Nude space vampires. Ooh. And then this was his kind of kiddie... It stars a kid who can't trust his parents and giant, puppet monsters want to eat him. It looks ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Though that was all Hooper's output with Golden Globus. He did Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which was just really a comedy. It was not a horror film. He did Life Force, which included Patrick Stewart kissing a dude while being his mind was taken over by the nude vampire lady.
I cannot
remember. And then they made Invaders from Space.
That sounds awesome, though.
Mm-hmm. Life Force sounds like it's kind of bad, but it's beautiful.
Mm. I never did see it because I was disappointed when I realized it wasn't based the on the, the NES game.
But man, if you'd seen that when you were 16, you'd have been like, "Boy, swing." That's what straight guys say, right?
Tobey Hooper making fun movies with hard R's,
But also Space Camp?
Space Camp.
Yes.
An impossible mistake launched them into space. The adventure of their lives will be getting back home. Space Camp.
This is great.
This was one I saw a million times. This is one of those that's it's probably PG and it's for kids. So they ran it over and over and over everywhere.
Dude, I saw it at church camp.
Church camp.
Church
dun,
camp.
Dun, dun, dun.
But also note, this is not as fresh for us because it's old. But remember one of our first episodes of this very show?
No.
What had happened in the news?
No, the Challenger.
The Challenger exploded. Within 6 months of this movie being... This is them delaying the film.
Yeah.
It was supposed to release in early 1986. And it is about an accidental launch involving a fuel tank.
Wow.
It was really, really uncomfortable. And the movie bombed horribly. And it's largely attributed to this being a very, very raw subject
for America.
Nobody
wanted to go watch that.
It's about kids who go to space camp. They're running a training routine. And it just seems so stupid. Whoops, we accidentally fired the ship into space. And the kids must try and navigate the space shuttle back home.
Wow. It's got so many people in it, though.
Totally.
I mean, Leah Thompson, I guess, is the star.
Kelly Preston.
Kelly Preston's in it. Joaquin Phoenix, when he was a little Leaf Phoenix.
Yep.
He's a little guy, and he befriends a robot, and it's the robot's fault. It's a little sentient robot that fucks up the computers to send him into space because he wants to go there so bad.
In the clip I saw, also made a reference to the then timely Ed Grimley.
Oh, wow.
And it's making me
Ed
mental.
Ed Grimley is forever.
Yeah.
I must say.
Space Camp, though, it's a really fun 80s movie, though, if you got kids and
very,
want to get nostalgic.
Very goofy, but it is fun.
I somehow never saw this. Despite being really into space and shuttles and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's filmed at Space Camp, if you ever wanted to go there.
I've been there. Huntsville, Alabama. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I saw it. For some reason, it's one of those movies that I didn't know the name of, and it's a scene stuck out at me. They're running out of air, and just the black dude just gives this speech, and like, I used to hold my breath for like 6 minutes. All I do is think about French fries. And he just delivers this great soliloquy about like when these kids are losing air.
Wow. So moving out of movies into TV.
All right. So I think the rest of our summer episodes, you guys need to keep this in mind. In 86 and to a degree in 96, television ends in the summer, like especially in 86. Like, I was searching for any kind of like special, like there's no new episodes of anything.
Mm-hmm. No.
There's no summer series. There's no reality shows to keep up on there. And this week, in the next 2 weeks, actually, there weren't even like the Miss USA pageant. There wasn't anything. Mm-hmm. And
it's just like reruns and baseball.
Yeah, reruns and sports.
Yeah.
And so
it'll be the NBA finals.
Ended last week in 86. There's been an expansion teams now.
Okay.
So they
should have brought it up.
Season lasts longer. But the one thing on American television this week.
Woo! Stepping softly in a danger zone. No weapon in my hand.
This is great.
Really tell it's.
It's just this phrase. Designed by man. Got me in trouble again.
With the voice of Anthony Daniels.
And R2-D2 as himself. That's how he's credited.
He's still in canon, an actual droid.
This is great. You recognize. I love that you can definitely recognize the voice. Because it's Stuart Copeland from The Police. But more importantly,
boy, is it.
It's like you're recognizing an ingredient of The Police. Because the Police is not all Sting. It's the harmonization of these other guys. And so this is the missing piece of The Police, Stuart Copeland.
It's those three guys. But so, this is June 7th, the final episode of Droids aired. It was a two-parter, and they aired it on TV. Now, Droids came in a weird time in Star Wars. In 83, as has been talked about many times, I think, on this show, that in 83 with Jedi, George Lucas was just like cold turkey, like, done. Like, no more Star Wars toys, no more Star Wars nothing. Like, I'm done with Star Wars.
If I may, just, I know you did more research on this, but I mentioned this to you guys because there was a recent revelation and what this is important for. The Star Wars Christmas special, in the middle of it, had an animated sequence that introduced Boba Fett, and Boba Fett is... In that, an empire is launched to be the ultimate badass, and everybody's like, what the fuck happened? And he gets jobbed out in Jedi so hard. And somebody just said, like, oh, here's what happened. Yeah, he was supposed to be the big bad in Jedi. And George was going to do three more movies. And he would be the next big bad. And then he said, George, like, fuck this. I'm tired. I'm not doing three more movies. Let's kill this guy because I'm done.
Just so, showing how much he didn't care about his old plans anymore, that he just kills
You probably
could have
guessed it, but Boba Fett premiered in animation.
Right.
And that animation went on to become Droids. Droids is canonical with the Star Wars universe.
It was
until it's now the Legends universe.
So, and that Boba Fett scene, which is like the only good thing about, the only like marginally good thing about the Christmas special.
It's beautiful.
That scene was animated by Nelvana, the Canadian cartoon company who...
Care Bears.
Care Bears. They did the, I believe, the Earthworm Jim cartoon. Mm-hmm. I remember that as well.
But above board for TV animation.
Droids was in 86. It actually started in 85. And compared to mid-80s cartoons, like you compare it to He-Man, it fucking kills He-Man. From a production standpoint, from a quality standpoint, from hiring Anthony Daniels and crediting him in the opening and having a real opening song written by a chart-topping pop
and
musician.
Relative to the concurrent show, The Ewoks, which I loved, but it holds up way worse. They're the Smurfs with fur.
And it also took place very clearly in the timeline of this is before Star Wars. They met the same stock hero types that you'll see in most expanded universe Star Wars stuff. So it's just like, this guy's basically Luke Skywalker, except he's on a different place.
And here's John Bolo, the scruffy rogue.
Researching this a long time ago because I like, what universe we're living in where a Star Wars show didn't succeed.
Yeah, why was it
on
just
Saturday
one
morning?
Year?
But as far as I can find, like, one, George Lucas didn't care that much, and two, it was like incredibly expensive.
Yeah,
as you know, to point out how much it cost.
It
and
looks
how much,
like it compared to like Alvin and the Chipmunks or something at the time.
Yes,
yeah.
And also that it's one of those Star Wars things that, like, this has never been on home video or DVD in a complete format.
I don't know, in our lifetimes it had finally collected, released. Oh, never. Okay, never. Well, I remember as a kid, I remember like a couple episodes on VHS.
Yeah, around when episode one came out, they bombarded everything with, I guess, just the first episodes.
They edited
maybe
together on DVD, like four of the episodes into 2-hour movies that are totally disjointed and awful. They edit out the theme song that it's never been on video format.
Somebody didn't
bizarre
sign the right contract.
There's money in Star Wars everything except for this? What?
Yeah. No, it is an odd choice. And also now that they have just the way of saying, like, these are Star Wars legends. Like, none of it counts anymore. So it can't harm you. Like, it can't harm. I could see when Lucas was like, hey, I don't like recognizing this because C-3PO and R2 were on a spaceship with Bail Organa the entire time between episodes 3 and 4. They weren't having dumb adventures on Tatooine or whatever, or wannabe Tatooine in the show.
Although I do believe a character did appear later in Shadows of the Empire for N64.
Yes, yeah. That's something else that was always fun in later Star Wars things when the fans would work on Expanded Universe stuff and just sneak in dumb characters from the cartoons they saw in their youth to make them canonical.
Right.
And, like, George Lucas probably wouldn't have even caught it, like, if they put in Slee Black McGeef Gorf or whatever.
McGeef.
So did no Star Wars TV thing ever work until Clone Wars?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
They never really tried. They always said they were going to do that live action.
Yeah,
I just kind of assume it's a budget thing. It's just too expensive to do something properly that fans are going to like.
Do you remember that hard-on George Lucas had for a live-action Star Wars series? But he was very vocal about, someone has to pay up front, and I'm not going to do it unless you commit to 100 episodes. And everybody's like, eat shit, George. No.
That's like $1 billion. Yeah, it's like, that, no one would do that.
Yeah, but again, like, it's the only property you could put that price tag on.
But speaking of animation,
Paul Dini worked on it as well.
Yes.
Yes, instrumental in all the DC animated stuff of our youth. But animation, you wrote down because there's so little going on in TV across the pond.
So I decided to look to 1986 anime to fill some of the TV void.
Yeah, I'll see you later
in the upcoming episode. So, you know, it was funny for me to look at what was on TV in Japan in 1986 because this was the stuff that I would be paying $30 a pop for two episodes of in 1996.
Yep.
And that was the case, or even really 1999. That's the case with this show that is currently airing. It had premiered on March 26, 1986 in Japan, and that is Maison Ikkoku. Let's hear that theme. Yeah.
So? He's reading a character. Practicing.
Picture a character running towards a school.
No. It's a girl with an apron on drifting around a house.
Oh, I'm bored.
I do recognize this opening, though. God,
I'm not looking forward to this summer.
So what is...
All right. I love Maison Ikkoku. Now, you think, like, it's actually one of the more mature, like, sitcom-style animes I've ever seen. Like, it is a romantic comedy, but starring people in their 20s. Like, the lead characters...
In anime terms, 20s is basically grandparents.
Yes, yeah, so... it takes place in Maison Ikkoku, which is, you know, the
still
French word Maison.
12.
Sorry. Okay.
What's it about, Henry? Come on.
All right. It is.
I'm going to turn the music off.
It is a romantic comedy set in an apartment where there's five rooms in it, and the main character, Godai, is a struggling college student who's trying to get his shit together, and he gets a new landlord, and the landlord who runs the place is this widower named Kyoko, and he falls in love with her, and it is a romantic comedy where they slowly get to know each other, but there's like real growth. It is a clear, like, linear story of people aging kind of in real time, and just like he starts going to school, she's dealing with the death of her husband, other characters come and leave the place. It's a very funny, like, and
I would like to get off this
show.
Elevator pitch right now.
Look, I'm just saying, it is, if you... It is.
How long did it run for?
It ran for only 2 years, but for 96 episodes. It was well. That's something too with what you should know about anime TV series. In
Man,
most cases,
I didn't know I could do this, but I actually have a live feed of listeners to the show, and it's cratering. It's crazy.
Something you don't know about anime series is that they rarely do reruns. Like it is first every week, all the time, and so. It was 2 years and 96 episodes. It just wouldn't stop airing. But this was created by Rumiko Takahashi, who's one of my all-time favorite comic book writer artists around. Mm. She did Your Side, Sura, Ranma One Half, Inuyasha. Those are big things. And this is one of her more underrated ones. But it's just it's such a beautiful show that also, you know, gives you a look at what real life was like in Tokyo back in 1986.
That sounds interesting.
Real life.
No, it's a really it's such a down to earth show. There's no twist to it.
Sure.
Like there, and
so why is it animated?
This dog.
Because it was based on a manga, and so they just
so you can't just do a live action.
There were some live action adaptations as well, but it also
it's kind of like King of the Hill, where it's like we just have this idea, and animation is like we view it as a legitimate way to convey it. So.
Okay.
Rather than hire actors, we'll hire voice actors.
We just talked about it on a bonus time when I watched only yesterday. And, like, there is...
Yeah.
It seems like this was 16 times the price because you animated it.
Can I just say, I'm looking over, as Brett was looking at the Wikipedia page on it, to see that the little logo for anime and manga is just a giant fucking eyeball.
It's the big anime eye.
That's the Japanese CBS logo, by the way.
And it also served a purpose as an animated series because Rumiko Takahashi's stuff was hotter than ever at that point. And her original series, Your Side, Sura, which was a huge hit on TV, had ended. Like, it had reached its final episode. They had done over 200 episodes. Mm. And so they're like, well, we need to replace it in its time slot. You've got this new book. Let's animate that. And so that's how Meizan
Ikkoku... And then the credit song was this thing by the Police, I guess.
And the only other thing I'll mention about it is that they had... they had these fun music video openings a couple times where they got the 70s song Alone Again Naturally, and they animated that as the opening, which is
the saddest song ever.
Yeah, very fun song about a man's choice to take his own life, which is very
fucking
fun.
Japan, man. Like, they somehow the saddest Japanese stuff guts me more than anything else ever has.
But anyway, yeah, Meizan Ikkoku, seriously, look it up. It's great, classic anime. I love it so much that the Kyoko and Godai's romance is a very, like, by anime standards, a very mature story of two real-seeming people falling in love. Even it's still funny. If you've ever seen a weird chicken-type thing with Pio Pio written over it, like, that is from this show.
So when does somebody get fucked with a tentacle?
Never.
Okay. Music this week, taking us out of the 80s. Madonna's Live to Tell is number one.
I like this song.
Which was used in the Sean Penn movie
Range.
Yeah.
Right.
Which came out in April.
Yeah, ages ago.
Yeah, we talked about that one already. But Live to Tell is number one. However, this is a big week for music. Genesis.
The album,
Invisible Touch.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
6 million sold. Their biggest Genesis hit, at least up to that point, maybe ever, probably ever.
Probably.
Suck it, Peter Gabriel.
Has Land of Confusion, Invisible Touch, Tonight.
Yep.
Huge, huge, huge album.
Oh, my God. So unavoidable.
Yes. And this is
good.
Yeah, but this is also, man, I'm blanking on his name.
Phil Collins?
Phil Collins, there it is. Yeah, this is after he's totally absorbed himself into Genesis. But before, I think he has ejected himself into solo stardom. Or is it going concurrently?
I think it was concurrent at the time. He had like a hit solo album at Genesis being big at the same time. He was like, I can be both, man.
And Peter Gabriel, just we talked about like a few weeks ago, had his big...
He
quit, and Phil Collins, the drummer, stepped up to the microphone.
My drummer.
Interesting.
But taking us out, because it's my show.
Yay.
Damn.
And you'll hear Genesis later, and also you've heard it enough. Randy Travis, Storms of Life.
Yeehaw!
So again, this is country from my era, and the song Digging Up Bones from Storms of Life. This is such a treat. You're all going to love it, I promise. When we come back... What happened this week in 1996?
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of a love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Surely you know what Audible is right now. You clearly enjoy things coming in your earbuds or your headphones. Audible is the internet's leading source for audiobooks, radio shows, old-time radio dramas, spoken entertainment, as they say, with over 180,000 titles to choose from that you could then listen to on your iPhone, Android, iPad, desktop. Doesn't matter. Audible supports all of that stuff. Of course, Audible has books like Harry Potter, the Game of Thrones series, the Girl with the blank, blank, blank series from a Scandinavian country that I haven't read. But how about, look at this. Ooh, look at that. Slimed, an oral history of Nickelodeon's golden age. I know we've talked about that book many a time here on Laser Time, and you can get it free just by going to audibletrial.com/lasertime and starting with your free 30-day trial and get a free audiobook. Hey, that's not enough. I just found out. Look at this. Dan Aykroyd's dad has a book called The History of Ghosts, which is apparently about a brief history of ghosts and the Aykroyd family ghost stories that inspired the movie Ghostbusters. And remember, LaserTime listeners can go to audibletrial.com/LaserTime and get started with a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook. Thank you, Audible.
There's a hostage situation on Alcatraz.
June 7th, you refuse payment, I launch the gas.
This chemical is beyond anything you can imagine.
Alcatraz is on the rock.
He broke out successfully.
Is back in business.
Welcome to the rock.
From the producers of Top Gun and Crimson Tide.
You join us?
Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage, Ed Harris.
That's just about the most awful thing I've ever seen.
The Rock, directed by Michael Bay, rated R.
Oh, Lordy. I've never seen Henry come alive so fast.
I love this song.
I've seen them live. The Squirrel Nut Zippers?
Yeah, I saw them live, too. It's a free show.
It's fun, but, like, man, that fucking return to swing movement that was allegedly supposed to happen reminds me of, like, the news giving, like, an E. coli scare. We were told there'd be a swing revolution, and then there was, like, four songs they played ad nauseum until we all hated it, and this was one of them.
Like, Squirrel Nut Zippers, what? Cherry Poppin' Daddies.
Brian Setzer Orchestra.
Yeah,
my mom still loves them.
And khaki commercials for years.
Yes.
But that Squirrel Nut Zippers, hot. Their second
doesn't
album.
Take the boss tones, though.
Yeah. Hell is the song anyone might know, and that's what brought us in, was hot. In the afterlife.
I love that song.
I don't know if they did it when you saw them, Chris, but I noticed they were just constantly swapping instruments.
Yeah.
It's like everybody played everything.
I think in terms of the throwback music style, they were also, if you can see them live, they're throwback showmen, and it's like it's a really fun show to see. I wish I was dead every time it comes on the radio.
You know, no.
If I recall correctly, that song
we've had
is
20 years to get it out of your system. It's still fun.
No,
it's
way.
Okay.
Look, if you put that song on now, you can literally be arrested for being white.
Can I what about like, you get arrested for
not in Trump's America?
If I'm too white to listen to a little Randy Travis,
hey, that's 86.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. I
there's no target demographic for this entire program.
I know. Also, out this week, Ice-T 6, Return of the Real.
Maybe some of the track list, would you?
Oh, I don't have it up. Oh, I'd rather not, actually. Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of tracks I would be arrested for.
Yes.
But Kenny Chesney, Willie Nelson, Lost Boys, all had new albums. Lost Boys, Legal Drug Money. But for me, again, this is one of those things where the way I'm going to veer on the show, Robert Miles,
dude,
and the album Dreamland, which is just a dance trance.
You've heard Robert Miles is one of those. You've heard it. You've heard all these songs, whether you know it or not.
Yes, okay. We will go out. I'll definitely play a song as we go out. But it's just a dance electronic album. And I remember watching MTV as you would do in the 90s, and like this song came on at like 1 a.m, and like a minute in, I'm like, if no one says any words in this, I'm buying this tomorrow. Yeah. And the whole time I'm watching the video, like, please don't talk. Please don't talk. Yeah. And so when the song was over, I was like, wow, damn. That was a real-ass dance song on MTV.
You know, they played it at 1 a.m. just to give MTV the excuse to use it in all their programming and commercials. Yeah. It's like,
but this is the
all heard this song.
I am, you know what? Since I've never thought about these things together, I'm willing to go to bat for the idea that the return of swing was a reaction to dance music.
Yeah, probably. Or the sports swingers.
I mean, the 90s was also just like, everybody's rich. Yeah. So, like, yeah, I mean, everybody's loaded.
Everybody's loaded. We don't have enemies anymore.
Yes. It's the can't-fail 90s.
Our president got a blowjob, and we're all getting the benefits.
President got a blowjob, yet we all came.
It came out in the UK this week, Robert Miles' Dreamland. The US comes out in July and August, but like I just wanted to talk about it briefly. Yeah. It's an album I listen to a lot. I think I beat Link to the Past once to this with an imaginary soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Like I would, anytime I went back to the overworld in Zelda, I would switch back to like track 4. And if I was in a labyrinth, I switched to track 8. If I'm in a boss battle, I switched. I had a specific track list for this in mind. Doesn't go well at all, but I didn't care. News this week, though, Max Factor dies.
Oh, yeah, Max Factor Jr. dies.
That's the name of a person?
Max Factor was two people.
What?
There was the original Max Factor, who basically created movie makeup as we know it.
And the other one who wrote Hawkeye... it's a Matt Fraction reference. Right. Thank you. You're welcome, comic book fans.
I giggled.
Yeah. So the first Max Factor, he came over in like the 1910s and developed makeup that would look good on film under the hot lights.
The light.
It wouldn't crease. It wouldn't cake. And he died in 38. And his son, Max Factor Jr., changed his name to that so people would believe him. He he took over the company and he developed... makeup to use in color films that would look the right tone. It would look good under lights. It wouldn't run. It wouldn't cake. And then they realized, so many stars were stealing it and taking it home because they liked it. They're like, we'll start a whole company and sell it to the public.
Wow.
So yes, jeez. Max Factor was a person.
Wow. I never knew that. Welcome to 302010.
Thank you for the women's view on makeup.
But he made it to 91. That's pretty good.
Max Factor 2 made it to 91.
I don't know anything about makeup except the guy who made the Planet of the Apes mask. That's it.
Yeah. We talked about FX. That was an interesting movie.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Also this week, an important film.
There are some who say he is only a myth. Soon they will discover the Phantom is real.
Hey,
Slam Evil!
I can't believe...
Worst logline of all time.
I can't believe this is 96, because it feels like not just a throwback to obviously the 30s, but a throwback to more the early 90s.
And then
when you compare that, it came out the same week as another movie that we're about to talk about, which looks like a sign of what's to come in action movies.
Yeah.
This is weird.
Yeah, everything about this, so it's Billy Zane starring as the... just devastatingly popular comic strip character, Phantom.
Like if you had
even in 96,
there wasn't like a superhero genre at that point.
No, like and all we had were Batman movies.
We have Batman movies, and the Phantom is 3 years older than Batman, yet totally lost to time now.
That's weird. We didn't have comic book movies. We had comic strip
movies.
Yeah, because this and the Shadow.
Yeah, well, I mean, this came
but
after
we got,
Shadow,
we
Dick
got
Tracy.
Shadow and Dick Tracy, too.
And this is the Phantom, starring Billy Zane, based on a comic strip created in 1936. At its peak, it was said to be read by 100 million people. I'm pretty sure that stat should read, it was sent to 100 million people. It was created by Lee Falk, who worked on the strip until he died in 1999. 60 years of writing the Phantom, and it is still being published. I told this on a story recently on another podcast, but I love comic strips. I had my grandparents save their comic strips in their towns so I could go read them, and our town never had the serials. And the Phantom I loved Marvel and DC. I always I'm going to try this Phantom thing. It was impossible to follow in comic strip form. It's such a horrible way to tell
a
story.
Once a day, four panels.
Well, that reminded me as a kid, there'd be Prince Valiant in the Sunday stuff. You'd be like, who even reads this?
Mary Worth? My grandparents, where they were. They had it when they had an evening and morning newspaper, they got it because they'd been reading it for 60 fucking years.
But, when are we going to get an adaptation of Mark Trail?
Well, the Phantom, I think, did kill a lot of future comic strip hero adaptations, and his costume in the movie is... it's the why you don't take it right off the page excuse. Yeah. You can't do exactly
it's
what's
just
on
like hip hugging purple.
Yeah.
He's just in a purple body stocking.
They were trying to build him a Batman-esque muscle suit for Billy Zane. Wow. And instead he just got super fucking ripped. Mm-hmm. And you don't even fit in this costume anymore. You look awesome, so they just put spandex on him. It doesn't hold up very well.
No.
The other cool factoid is that they had to shoot a lot of scenes ahead of time. because in order to fit in the costume, Billy Zane had to shave his head. And during the scene where he reveals himself, that scene had to be shot weeks earlier.
Wow.
Where he shows his hair because he could not fit in with his hair, and then ironically never grew it back. Poor Billy Zane.
Oh, really?
Well, eventually.
Well, yeah, no, he was in the sixth season of Community, and I didn't know it until the credits. Like, that's Billy Zane? Like, he's bigger, he has a big beard, and he's just
He's an unsung treasure, and I think this was supposed to be his big star push, and it sucks that he got caught up in one of a semi-notorious failure.
I just remember the line from this, no one can resist the Phantom.
Yeah,
it's like, the box office did.
It looked cheap, too. Like, it looked real...
We watched it a couple years ago.
I'm so pissed you did that without me.
It was great.
Yeah?
Man, what a treat to watch this movie. It was bizarre.
It's a big-budget 90s thrill,
bizarre as shit, and the fact that, Billy Zane looks doughy and gross in this outfit, and the whole time we're like laughing, ha ha ha, and then he takes the suit off and it's like, you are ripped. That suit makes you look terrible,
way stupider,
and you look better than the drawing of a perfect man's body. Like,
well, that's also,
how did this happen?
He was way ahead of his time in that now movie actors have to be monstrously huge dudes now. Like, back then, Michael Keaton, I bet he couldn't do many push-ups back then. But here was Billy Zane dressed up, getting in super good shape. Another interesting thing about it, I only realized when working at a video store, I put it on the TV after we watched Rocketeer. We're like, oh, hey, we just watched Rocketeer, let's watch this one. And we didn't realize how similar they were in that they are period piece superhero films that also... star as a villain, as a love interest or villain, a future Best Actress Oscar winner. And that's Catherine Zeta-Jones in Phantom and Jennifer Connelly in...
supporting actresses, thank you.
And are they both set in the lead-up to World War II, not during World War II?
Well, I know Rocketeer is that. I think Phantom is in...
Phantom is definitely that. Okay. I checked.
All right. So, 30's awesome.
More importantly this week, though, a much bigger movie...
You sure you're ready for this?
I'll do my best.
Your best? Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen.
Ba-da-ba-da! You put those words in Sean Connery's mouth? That's so crazy.
Yelling at Nick Cage, The Rock!
I have never seen this.
Really? I saw it in the theater, but
this is the dawn of Bay, right?
This is it, baby.
Yeah, it is the beginning of Bay.
This is the end. This is the end of movies.
Yeah, end of film.
Top Gun was billed as the end of movies 10 years earlier, though, wasn't it?
And then it took Jerry Bruckheimer another 10 years to finally kill a film with The Rock.
Sean Connery's in two number one movies in the span of 2 weeks with this and Dragonheart.
Dragonheart and this,
Well, yeah, I watched this film long before I would ever even think I'd be moving to the Bay Area. And when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, hey, this really only is the big driving scene that makes it feel like this is in San Francisco, but
the driving scene that is it's like a bright yellow sports car versus like a Humvee, and there's a cable car explodes, which makes no fucking sense.
And it goes straight up into the air.
It's just made of metal.
It hit the fucking gas tank.
There's no gas tank. It's great. Yeah. I didn't even know that until I moved here, that there is an underground crank that pulls the cable cars. Yeah. There is no gasoline or volatile fluid.
Yeah,
we
need to stop making those cable cars out of Semtex. Yeah. That was a bad idea. Yeah.
There's another one of those Michael Bay things where his ties with the military, he gets F-18s, they fly over Alcatraz. It's all about terrorists in the middle of Alcatraz. They're going to, nuke the city or
white nationalist terrorists, by the way.
I've never seen this, but I do live in the city where it's set, and I also went to the prison where it was filmed, which ironically it was one of the most expensive prisons ever built in Georgia, I believe, and it was too expensive to run, so it was never used, and the first time it ever got used is the scene of Sean Connery being alone, isolated, and solitary. That is the only use the prison got. I hope that's changed.
I wouldn't, you know what? It's in Georgia. Mm-hmm. I bet that's where Walking Dead filmed.
Probably.
But the movie, The Rock is about, they have to break into Alcatraz, and they have to they hire the one guy who's ever broken out of it.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood. Oh, wait, no.
Sean Connery. And he takes him...
It's not confirmed, Diana.
He takes him through all the different bits of it. He's just like, this is a ridiculous death trap, but it's what you got to do to break in. And Nick Cage is the everyman of it, and this is at the beginning of Nick Cage, the action star as well.
1 year later, he would be in Con Air.
Wow.
Yeah.
Basically the same film.
The Bruckheimer joint.
Yeah. Budget was $75 million. This movie made $335 million.
Now, it was, I mean, it has some amazing visuals in it, like seeing Sean Connery race down the giant hills of San Francisco in the opening scene, and then also the shot of, like, Nick Cage bent over
showing the flares, don't shoot the missiles, no.
And it also introduced me to record snobbery in that at the beginning of the film, he gets a Beatles album on vinyl, and then his coworker's like, why don't you just get it on CD? And he's like, one, because I'm not a fucking Philistine.
I prefer the purity.
People need pops and crackers.
It's a warmer sound.
Yeah. Man. Revolver Man. Yeah, man.
And I like the cute bit at the end where they get that microfiche that he hid, and he asks his wife, like, well, hey, you ever want to know who killed JFK? Like, because it's right
and
here.
We all left the theater.
It was me.
Apropos of nothing, did anybody finally invent the megafiche? There has to be a bigger version of it. The clarity is amazing.
That's just a laser disc.
It's
so. TV this week, Henry.
All right. The only
final episode.
The only big deal is the June 9th was the final episode aired of Sequest DSV.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, known as Sequest 2032.
R.I.P.
Let's hear the opening. Let's get a little explanation.
21st century, mankind has colonized the last unexplored region on Earth, the ocean. As captain of the Sequest and its crew, we are its guardians. For beneath the surface lies the future.
So Star Trek is so big at this point, someone's like, you know what else is a final frontier?
Yep.
The ocean.
What if we put the Enterprise in a sub? Like, it's so funny. The Enterprise was like a sub film, and some of it's like Wrath of Khan is a submarine movie in space, and now they make a space, they take it from space back to submarines for the show.
I remember the Appetite
Roy
being...
Roy Scheider, R.I.P.
Was he in this?
Roy Scheider's
the
star.
Jonathan Brandis, R.I.P.
Roy Scheider, he's going back to kick some more shark ass, man. He's sick of their bullshit.
So premiered in 1994 on
and Ted
NBC.
Raimi.
We're going to need a bigger budget.
On NBC. It was created...
and
starring Darwin the Dolphin.
Darwin the Dolphin, voiced by Frank Welker. That's the only thing people really remember from
it.
Oh, my God, that's right.
Yep.
I always thought maybe like I was confusing it with Johnny Mnemonic, because that's got a talking dolphin in it. But that's right. There is a psychic talking dolphin on this show.
So it was thought up by Steven Spielberg, and it was one of his like early
track
TV
record
production
things.
Yeah, sure is. And, well, but in 94, like from the beginning, it lost its way. Like halfway through the season... They're making up plots and storylines that are getting people like they bring in aliens in the first season, and Roy Scheider is not into it. Like multiple actors like are quitting the show. And also Ted Raimi was on the show. He was like science officer, whatever.
Spider-Man.
Yes, but Roy Scheider was the key to the show, though. Also, there was Jonathan Brandis, the Wesley Crusher of the show, though. More handsome than Wesley Crusher,
of Ladybug's fame.
Of Ladybug's fame and of...
Burning Story 2.
Who would later kill himself in 2003 after his career kind of stalled out.
The appetite was so big for something like Star Trek, but the network seemed so reluctant to do it. And this was an example of one of those shows. Everybody wanted to see a show like this, jumped on board, and it immediately got bad, and they got complacent, and the audience fell off.
It started as hard sci-fi, and then it got weirder and weirder. The second season was when the big shakeups happened.
Wow.
They moved production to Orlando. They filmed it at Universal. I remember going to Universal Studios and being told, like, they filmed Sequest here, like, oh, maybe I should watch Sequest. But no episode made any sense because they shook up the status quo all the time and constantly killed off characters. And Roy Scheider famously like hated the show in the second season, where in one episode they literally meet the Roman god Neptune. He's like, this show has gotten terrible. I did not sign on for an action sci-fi
thing.
This
is what Neptune said?
That's what Scheider said. And so they forced him to do 3 episodes in season 3, but then quit otherwise. And then they do the other thing in season 3, which they do in all struggling retooling of like, it's the time jump. It's 10 years later. And that's when it becomes Sequest 2032. Michael Ironside is running the ship. And it's a more militaristic political show, which honestly sounds more interesting to me.
Yeah.
But that gets canceled in 13 episodes in that season, and they leak out the last of it on June 9th and only got to 57 episodes. And so, it's more famous for the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Right.
that only Jonathan Brandis is the only actor who is on every episode, though Ted Raimi is close that he was on most of them, just about every single one. Just every other actor was just like, I quit, or they get hired halfway through, and they were just, it was too, most people blame it on NBC executives not getting the show and constantly retooling it to try to attract a new audience and instead scaring off whatever audience they had. Like, historically, sci-fi is not very successful on, on NBC. And the only other thing about it is I would say the creator of the show, Frank O'Bannon, he would go on to do Farscape, which would be, I guess, his bigger show that he created.
Jim Henson co-production.
Yes.
Games this week taking us out of 1996, because video games in 86, like we've said, rarely has any big news happening at this point in 1986. And 96 is not much is different, because games coming out in the summer was pretty rare. Back then, Frank Thomas Big Hurt Baseball, which is one of those, like, I know it, I've never played this game, but and the only reason I know who Frank Thomas is because he has a game called Big Hurt Baseball, and from that I will derive the fact that he's probably known for being aggressive on the field.
So I don't believe
Xbox players don't have a baseball game. We had several starring everybody.
Well, I don't believe this had the MLB license in it. This was at a time where MLB was very slow to license their... the teams to games, and then Players Association wouldn't give you the names of the players for a long time either.
So would they do like knockoff teams? It's like it's the Los Angeles Rogers.
Yeah, pretty much.
Or it would just be the name. Well, I just remember in RBI baseball, it'd just be like you're playing as Los Angeles.
Yeah, or just Chicago.
Yeah, I see.
And then didn't this is one of those vague dates, but Skeleton Warriors.
Excuse me?
Was a cartoon, I think.
Yeah.
It was a toy line, but there was this... It tried to get going and never really gained enough steam to become a thing. But I know some people who may be a little younger than us were probably into this in the early, in the mid-90s, but sometime there was a game that came out, PS1 Saturn, I think, and then Tommy Tallarico did the soundtrack to it, so there's some good music in there, too. But.
I remember it had, like, the kind of Donkey Kong fake CGI in it. It's 3D skeletons, but they just animated pictures of polygons.
Ah, interesting. I just remember the toys for being interesting of, like, here's just a bunch of cool riffs on skeletons. Like, here's one with four arms and a giant chest. Like, I don't know why.
one with skin!
I wasn't paying attention to it, but I always conflate it with, like, there was a mummy action show.
Mummy's Alive.
Mummy's Alive around the same time.
But we'll go out with one of those Robert Miles songs that I'm so fond of. And when we come back, what happened this week in 2006?
Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea, this is Diana's Classic Corner. We look even further back in time this week to see if there's anything worth a watching. And you know what? I actually spent a lot of time researching these. I watched a whole bunch of movies from 1966, 50 years ago this week, and every single one reminded me of a better movie. So I'm just going to recommend the better movies. June 9th, we had Khartoum, starring Charlton Heston, which is sort of a desert colonial action type movie. It was okay. It was a big moneymaker in 1966, but it just reminded me I'd rather be watching Zulu from 1964 with Michael Caine. Then we also have Paradise Hawaiian Style, the Elvis movie. Again, I just wish I were watching Blue Hawaii from 1961. And it's kind of sad if you watch them back to back to see how much Elvis ages in 5 years. So seriously, just stick with Blue Hawaii. It's so much better. And finally, also, these are all June 9th, 1966, Glass Bottom Boat, directed by Frank Tashlin, starring Doris Day. Frank Tashlin is so interesting a guy because he's, before Brad Bird, he's kind of the biggest director who went from animation to live action. I'm still not sure why this movie's called Glass Bottom Boat, though, because it's actually sort of like a spy caper. Like, it's all about, you know, these aerospace guys think that Doris Day might actually be a Soviet spy. It is a cartoon. It is just straight up, there's sound effects and goofy music, and it is just a cartoon. But if you're into that sort of thing, I think Frank Tashlin's other films are better, specifically Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter from 1957. That's so much fun. And he did that and The Girl Can't Help It with Jane Mansfield, and because she looks like a cartoon character, Frank Tashlin just nails it. So those are my recommendations for this week, and I'll see you later. Stay classic.
See me rolling, they hating, patrolling and trying to catch me riding dirty, 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 trying to catch me riding dirty. My music so loud, I'm swinging, they hoping that they gon' catch me riding dirty, trying to catch me riding dirty.
Bringing us in 2006, Chamillionaire, Riding, featuring Crazy Bone.
Wow, this marks the first time, and it's 10 years ago, Weird Al did a song parody of a song I've never heard.
Wow.
Yes, White and Nerdy, a.k.a. Riding, parentheses. Actually, it's, people think it's called Riding Dirty, when in fact it's just called Riding. Oh. But Chamillionaire, Chamillionaire, number one this week. Guest starring Crazy Bones from Bone Thugs and Harmony, who we'll talk about a little bit more next week's show.
Oh, okay,
but
good.
Also out this week, Ice Cube's Laugh Now, Cry Later, AFI's December Underground, and Nelly Furtado, actually, big album, Loose.
The name is she the Like a Bird Lady?
Yes, she was. And then she put on an album with Promiscuous, Say It Right, which is a song I really enjoy. Actually, I meant to play that to bring us in, but I saw Ride and couldn't resist. But that album, Nelly Furtado's song, album sold 12 million worldwide.
Wow.
It's a big hit. Again, Promiscuous and Say It Right are two big songs off this. I think Promiscuous will even be number one shortly after this. After this album,
I didn't pay attention to her after her first album.
Yeah, this is one. It was just on the radio, and this is when we were driving up and down 101 every day to go to work. So it's like this song was kind of everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But moving into movies, we talked about the breakup last week, the Jennifer Aniston, Vince Vaughn, whatever.
Sure,
and it was a movie. The Omen remake called The Omen 666.
Sorry, Chris Antista. Huh?
Oh, yes.
It's real bad.
Lee Shriver is the main
character. It exists entirely so it could be released June 6th, 1996.
I cannot believe that was the movie that like hunkered down
in 2006.
Yes, June 6th.
666.
06, yeah.
They had a date. They got to make a movie. 06.
The original Richard Donner.
Yep.
And is a great movie.
Yep.
And this one is not. Nope. It's just like a weird, like one of those like needlessly, like... It opens with like a church looking at like the signs have been around all along, and then just they go to all these great lengths to explain certain things, and then the original is just like, this is the status quo, accept it or not or get out. It's just like, watch the movie or don't. Do you need to believe why the church thinks it's the end days are here?
I think
the demon's here from the beginning. He replaced it. They changed out the baby. The end.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that I like about the remake is I like the idea of casting Mia Farrow as the evil nanny. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
but again, rather than watch this Omen remake, just watch the original. Big movie, though, this week that is inescapable.
Hey, Lightning, you ready?
Oh, yeah.
The rookie sensation came into the season unknown, but everyone knows him now.
I love you, Lightning!
You're my hero, Mr. McQueen.
Fred, thank you.
He knows my name. He knows my name!
Traders are finding Nemo.
Just wanted to hear the Smash Mouthy Route 66 cover.
All right, Cars, everybody.
Cars. Disney's most or Pixar's most successful film ever.
Yep.
Sorry about
that. Deal with it, people.
Sold 5 million copies on DVD in 2 days.
Whoa.
And has brought in $10 million in merchandise. As of 2011.
Wow.
And I think I go to the Disney store periodically in San Francisco, and like they only just got rid of like the first floor was just Cars.
Yeah.
I think Cars has finally left kids' minds.
Nope. Yeah, well, the third one is coming out next year.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I will say, I never saw this movie. I don't avoid Pixar movies by any stretch. I've seen probably most of them, I guess, but Cars is just one I was like, nah.
It's not bad. It's just not very Pixar.
Yeah,
It's a lot more DreamWorks, and it's brilliant in that because like it was such a merchandising boom. I don't know a little boy. I don't know why little girls don't care. Who doesn't love Cars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there hadn't been anthropomorphized Cars like at all. There'd been a talking Knight Rider. There'd been a couple of cartoons. Why did who? What took people so long to put eyeballs
well,
and voices?
I have
in,
one word for you.
What?
Transformers.
Yeah, but sure. But like this. But this was just straight up cars.
Yeah.
And like
yeah.
every little boy is going to have a car.
Sure.
Period. Why not be Lightning McQueen? Ka-chow.
Yeah. Ka-chow.
This, was this around the period where Owen Wilson tried to kill himself?
Well,
promoting
that
was the movie.
Later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I will say, even though I don't have any nostalgia for this movie or affection, mm-hmm. Cars Land at Disneyland
exactly.
is exceptional.
I was watching.
It's so fucking good.
Rewatching clips of it, like it's easy to hate Cars, but like the design is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
Like the
yeah.
deserts and the,
oh,
the locales.
Yeah.
It was made. It was Lasseter's return to directing mm-hmm. after he took like a year off mm-hmm. to travel with his family.
It's like basically heading up Disney, and he directed yeah. the second one.
But then he did. This was because he loves cars. Mm-hmm. Like he loves old school car mm-hmm. culture and driving Route 66, all that stuff. He mm-hmm. loves it. And that's why, like, most of the movie takes place in the forgotten pit stops of the 50s that they want people
yeah.
to start going to.
I know,
again.
That was the thing that I thought of. Like, the first thing I thought of walking out of the movie was, like, so they made a movie for kids about the economic impact
yeah.
of the interstate highway system?
Yeah. Yeah. The death of Route 66,
that's
essentially.
Exactly. We put in giant highways mm-hmm. in the 50s and 60s, and they do you know the straightest line from point A to point B, and they bypass all these little towns that used to be on the highway.
I didn't like how there's that awesome fan theory that like the cars are living in a universe humans built after we all die
mm-hmm.
and become
right.
sentient, because otherwise a bunch of cars in a stadium to watch cars doesn't make a lot of sense.
You don't get that much of a turnout for people running.
Yes,
in,
exactly.
I mean, yeah.
Well, what other sports are there for them?
They can play football.
Can they play car tennis? I don't know. They can't catch anything.
Why do you need to build a hotel for a thing that innately has a roof?
Well, that's what drove me crazy in seeing the trailers for Cars 2 of just like, they're going on planes? Like
that is notable in that it is the first Pixar trailer to feature any voices at that point.
Because
almost all Pixar trailers open with just a song and don't tell you shit. Oh, this immediately is like, here's our voices. It's also the last Pixar film of Disney legend Joe Raft.
Joe Raft, yeah, sadly. He would die in Berkeley. Like
in a car accident.
In my area, like miles from my home.
He's not given official co-directing credit, but I believe behind the scenes he is.
I mean, he was the idea guy.
He's a script shepherd. He's been working with John Lasseter since Brave Little Toaster when Disney fired them all.
Well, also, if you want to get grim, this was, I think, the last
Paul Newman.
Yep. Yeah.
The film is dedicated to both of them, and I don't think it's George Carlin's last film, but it's close.
It's got
to
be pretty close. I really like Paul Newman in this, and it's not just because, oh my God, I love Paul Newman and everything. Mm-hmm. The fact that in real life, he was a big racing enthusiast.
Yeah.
He raced semi-pro, and the idea of like, yeah, I mean, there's basically two big Hollywood stars that race semi-pro, him and Steve McQueen.
Yep.
So
George Lucas has really gotten into it,
so,
too.
Yeah, Lightning McQueen is named after Steve McQueen, and then you get Paul Newman in it as the sage old
yeah.
guy.
I believe Adam Carolla recently made a documentary about just that, Paul Newman and his racing career.
Nice.
But Michael Keaton is really good in it, too. Mm. Like, there's tons
of
good acting
in it. Oh, God, I always forget he's
it.
The bad guy.
I guess it's the mater of it all of why I've turned on it.
It's for little kids. That's why. It's just for little kids.
The most DreamWorks Pixar movie, whereas
yeah.
usually they defy convention and
create
something
especially the
new.
Casting of Larry the Cable Guy mm-hmm. to play such a broad character of himself. Like, it's a Robin Williams. It's of the Robin
yeah.
Williams genie.
It is
era
funny,
of
though.
Casting.
It's like when Pixar wants to be DreamWorks, they're better at it than
yep.
DreamWorks.
Yeah.
And they'll make the most money showing, like, oh, we could be creative and smart all day, but, like, people just want
to
watch.
Yeah, I resent this as Pixar's most successful film because of how much I like their other work,
sure.
but this is
yeah.
not a bad movie
right.
at
yeah.
all.
No,
yeah. Two is maybe
shit on
a bad
this
movie.
Cars 2 I thought was terrible.
Yeah. I'm not a fan
of that.
That
is the only one that was like, wow, I mean, visually it's beautiful, but I just feel like I wasted my time. This is for
yeah.
dumb babies.
And then fucking Mater everywhere. Like,
yeah.
The games were huge. THQ was able to stay alive probably a couple years longer
yeah.
because they're the Cars video games.
Yeah, later in this segment, I'll have reviewed one.
Yes, I had that written down that it was one of the first third-party launch games for the Wii. It was a launch game for the Wii, which there were not many from America.
Yeah, there was so many.
So many.
But also out this week was the Prairie Home Companion.
Prairie Home Companion.
I
feel like we have to wait people. This didn't happen on our message board. It happened on my friend's message board where they started making fun of this as the stupidest leftover baby boomer white culture nostalgia horseshit that has ever existed.
No.
It's Robert Altman's last film, weirdly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
the weirdest factoid I dug up is that the insurance had set aside money to pay Paul Thomas Anderson to
finish
the film if Robert Altman were to keel over and die, which
was on set watching it be made to be like, you can take over PTA if we need it.
Well,
and
yeah, because he was in his 70s and 80s.
he'd be dead this year.
And he'd have a heart transplant. He'd be dead a couple months from now. Yeah,
it's his last film. He got an honorary Oscar that year.
And he talks about like, well, you have a new heart. When he got his honorary Oscar, he's like, I got a new heart, so you're not going to be rid of me just because you're giving me a Lifetime Achievement Award.
One of the most amazing casts I'd ever seen assembled. Kevin Kline, Meryl Streep, Lily Tomlin, Woody Harrelson, John C.
Reilly. Altman all around. Yeah. Like, he always gets together like a dozen plus great actors and have them talk all at the same time, and that's a great film.
But the irony is, by the time you're hearing this, I will be watching one of the final performances of Prairie Home Companion live.
So when that the film is about the last a theoretical final episode of Prairie Home Companion.
So like, if you really like this podcast, and let's say we'd existed for a couple of decades, it's like we made a movie starring our internal characters that is also about the show. It's insane.
Let's do it.
As a concept, Kevin Kline is playing Guy Noir, a character from the show.
Guy Noir, and I feel so corny liking this movie.
Yeah, you do feel corny, and like I want to point out, Kill Bill is a throwback too, and like Turbo Kid and Kung Fury, those are all throwbacks. But those throwbacks didn't last 30 years. My dad, it was a throwback to like the old radio my dad listened to, so I grew up listening to this. He bought all the tapes. I would go to sleep listening to stories of Lake Wobegon. I've become a fan of Prairie Home Companion. I am embarrassed by it to say it publicly because it's the most uncool thing
it
a white dude can say.
It's the squarest thing in the world.
But I love old radio. I've seen it live before. It's just that it's one straight shot of people like well-rehearsed, sound effects live, people acting, comedy sketches.
My parents went to multiple shows of it, and even though my dad cannot stand Garrison Keillor's politics, he still love the old timiness
his
of it.
His voice is so soothing.
My parents would put it on, and he makes jokes about it now constantly. My parents put him on to put me to sleep.
It absolutely works.
I didn't hear him until 4 years ago, and as I'm driving, I had to drive a 40-minute commute to work every day, sometimes up to an hour each direction. In the morning, I would always. And then and I'm like, what is this? And then randomly someone made a Simpsons reference and I was like,
That's Garrison Keillor.
Oh my, and he's alive!
they savaged him in that episode. Stupid TV, be more funny!
And he's the main, I love in that Mike Nelson book, Death Threat, he's the Garrison Keillor character is the main villain of Minnesota Cartel. But I listen to this a lot. The movie's really great to emphasize the style of humor. Mm-hmm. Nobody listening will like this, especially if you got through Anime and The Rock. But this is emblematic of the humor in the film.
When God created woman, he gave her not two breasts, but three. When the middle one got in the way, God performed surgery. The woman stood before God with the middle breast in hand, said, what do we do with the useless boob? And God created man.
Bad jokes, don't you just live them? Bad jokes.
That is them in a Prairie Home Companion in a fucking nutshell. Yeah. That is what it is. It's an old-timey format with very 50, 60 adult-friendly humor.
So, here's the thing that pissed me off about the movie. Mm-hmm. They have Lindsay Lohan in it, and she does a fine job. But she plays who will be revealed to be Garrison Keillor's daughter with Meryl Streep. And the thought that Garrison Keillor, who wrote the film, wrote himself as having had an affair with a woman who looks like Meryl Streep, as a woman that Meryl Streep could play, I was like, no, fuck you. You do not get to. Wow. You don't get to write that. But the other thing I do like about it is it kind of reminds me, there's something I like about watching films by great auteurs like Robert Altman that are the final films. I like when it is like it's the last film and they know it's their last film like that. Hayao Miyazaki's The Wind Rises feels so much like this is your last movie. You're retiring.
Please
after
don't
this.
Make another film. It's so good.
But The Wind Rises is all about a man looking back at his life and saying like, oh yeah, I guess I did all that stuff. Like, time's over now though.
Yeah.
And that's the same with this, of like through Garrison Keillor reflecting on, well, this is the last night of my career and this is how I want it to be the last one, and people don't even know it's the last one. Characters die in it. There's the literal angel of death is in the film. It's hanging over it. Altman knew this was his last movie, I think.
Yeah.
TV this week. This...
I apologize for talking this much about Prairie Home Companion audience.
It's probably the only time it'll ever come up.
Yes, it'll never come up again.
TV series finale of Everwood?
Yeah, all right, look.
The Treat Williams Show?
So the TV show, yes. The Treat Williams Show, Everwood, from June 5th, final episode. It was a WB family drama that got... its cancellation was funny because this was the year where WB would then get together with UPN to become the CW in the fall. Mm-hmm. And not all these shows got to live. Everwood was one of them. And even though... Seventh Heaven had a real series finale. That show got renewed for an eighth season, and then Everwood got canceled in its place. And the only other thing that's worth remembering about Everwood is that was Chris Pratt's first major televised role, and this interview with him in his youth is amazing.
Don't believe me. Bright Abbott is that guy that everyone had in high school that was obnoxious and arrogant and extremely attractive. And for some reason, they cast me, which is weird, you know?
Okay. He's funny. You can see he's a funny fucker right from there. Like, a star is born.
Yeah.
On June 6th, it was the fourth season premiere of Last Comic Standing, hosted by that guy who starred in Boston Public, which we talked about in a previous episode. And the person who would win, I stopped watching the show at this point. I was not, even though I love stand-up comedy, I was not watching it. But the winner would be Josh Blue, a comic with cerebral palsy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've
seen
him.
See some of his act.
How y'all doing? All right. You know, people ask me if I get nervous before coming up on stage. I said, heck no, I got this many people staring at me all day.
That does... Man,
though I got to think, if you're one of the other comics on that show and you're competing against this the comic with cerebral palsy, you're just like, fuck, I'm not winning this show. Like, I'm not winning this popularity contest.
I remember that
nobody wants to be the person to beat the such a great story.
I remember comedy nerds taking issue with all the winners of the show, but it's exactly like the issues people take with American Idol.
Yeah.
Like, it's... Who won? The one everybody wanted to? Like, what difference does it make?
Our stand-up class that we took was taught by Curtis Matthews, who... He talked about, like, the biggest crowds he ever opened for was when he opened for Alonzo Bowden, the original winner of Last Comic Standing. Mm-hmm. And then there was a show that was way ahead of its time, premiered on June 7th, Dog Bites Man on Comedy Central.
Wow.
A show hosted by Matt Walsh that had 80 miles on it, but most famously, at the time, a nigh unrecognizable, unbearded, mustachioed Zach Galifianakis. And it was a kind of a spinoff of, well, not a spinoff of UCB, but it was like a fake reality show, or it was a reality show. They were playing characters who were pretending to be real news reporters interviewing real people about things and topics. One of my favorite episodes was when they did a fake talk show called the lead character, Matt Walsh's last name was Beacon, and the name of the talk show he was doing was called Beacon and Eggs, where to ask a question, the audience was supposed to ask questions, but to ask a question, you had to be eating a egg sandwich while asking. So it's like, this woman in the audience is like, hey, I want to ask a question. You're like, yeah, take a bite. And she's like, all right, but this, it's pretty much wiped off the internet. It's hard to find. It was just one season. But I did like this clip I found on Comedy Central from the episode Man Gaying It Up. Yeah.
Hey, are you the homosexual?
Am I the homosexual? Yes, I am. Okay.
Yeah, okay, so, camera, are we okay?
This is Kevin Beacon. I'm here with Ben Stilp of the Rainbow Alliance. Do you think gays are portrayed accurately in the media?
I think that's changed dramatically over the last, certainly the last 10 years that I've been working. It seems that there is an ever-expanding visibility of, I think, decent representations of lesbian and gays in the media.
You know what? Can I interrupt for a second? I like the question that you were just doing. I wonder if we could take that again. And I don't know if you would be able to maybe throw in, like, a girlfriend or something at the end, just so, like, you know, read a little bit more gay for the Spokane audience, kind of thing.
Girlfriend, what's another one? Fierce?
Just to read.
I did watch this because I was living alone and didn't know anyone in California.
Fresh
and I'm like,
off a news team.
And I had spent the last several years working in either in school getting a journalism degree or working at a TV station for news, and it was like, yeah, I'll watch this.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I thought it was funny.
It is a fun show. I also read an interview with Zach Galifianakis where he said the weirdest thing on the show for him was he didn't like doing it because he didn't like lying to people that much and just being a character in front of real people the whole time. He says he especially felt bad where they thought they'd find a religious dude to make fun of him, but he then meets this like old pastor who just talks very, very like eloquently about how much he loves God and the beauty of God, and like Zach Galifianakis just started crying instead of it was also, let me tell you guys, do not search on YouTube the phrase dog bites man, because you will never find this show, and instead horrifying pictures of men being bitten by dogs. Like pictures of like man, dog bites man, finger fell off, and it's like so don't do that. And then lastly, the MTV Movie Awards on June 8th, hosted by Jessica Alba, Wedding Crashers won Best Movie. But the big deal was Jim Carrey won the Generation Award for winning. So let me set this up real quick. It was that he had won more MTV Movie Awards than anybody at that point in 2006. So it's a lifetime achievement thing. He had done many crazy appearances to that point, like when he was filming Man on the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
He appeared in like a Jim Morrison bearded outfit,
right,
and said like, "There's a lot of hot pussy in this room."
Yeah. Demanded MTV play more Foghat.
Yeah, and so he's introduced by Will Ferrell, and then he comes out dressed all in white and with beatific music behind him, and just like all these people dressed as angels, and so he's acting like he's a man of God or from heaven here.
I wasn't aware until just recently that I had won more popcorn awards than anyone else in human history.
Kevin Spacey applauding.
But when I found out, I thought, wow, why am I so blessed? Why is my life so miraculous? Why do so many struggle with fame while I'm able to float effortlessly on the upper edges of the Hollywood stratosphere?
Yeah, it's cute. That's the best thing about the MTV Movie Awards. Like, they were a joke. Like, they are a joke and not a real way to honor anybody. But they knew how to have fun. They hired good writers who would write funny things. And, I mean, that's where I just look forward every year. Like, what will Ben Stiller, Will Ferrell, Vince Vaughn, and Owen Wilson do this year? Like, they will do something funny.
So the Lonely Island guys made it to SNL. Was for I think a year or two writing for the MTV Movie Awards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also Jessica Alba won an award while hosting for best sexy performance performance. Why, her striptease in Sin City.
I was going to say, flip the table over. You said Fantastic Four number one. Just
that wow, word out. What the hell?
Yeah, breaking.
Games this week, not a lot, again, because it's early summer and people just tend to not release games in the summer, except for this year, apparently, in 2016, because every week right now when we're recording this is something I want to play. But DS game Magnetica, I know you all remember that one.
Yeah.
Reviewed the Cars DS game, which was bad. The Gradius Collection for PSP, which is actually pretty good.
I'd love to have a version of that on something else.
Yes, and then Grand Theft Auto Liberty City Stories for PS2. It was a PSP game.
It was the biggest PSP exclusive that then got ported, kind of the admission, like, this isn't working.
This is not
this
a good place to play
enough.
It. Yeah.
They would repeat that with Chinatown Wars in just a couple of years.
Yeah, but at least Chinatown Wars worked on its original platform.
It's great.
That brings us into the show. Mm-hmm. You can follow us at LaserTimePodcast.com or LaserTime on Twitter.
Yeah, or Facebook.
Or Facebook. Mm-hmm. 302010 is supported by your efforts at Patreon.com/LaserTime. The show was unlocked thanks to you.
Yeah.
And hitting up that Patreon also gets you bonus time, our weekly show where we just goof right on you.
This is true. It's a little preparation.
There's prep on it.
And also,
but
if you want to check out the show on another platform, check out Wondery. Wondery.com/302010 or Google Play, Stitcher, we're everywhere you want to be.
And you know that Patreon also supported Talking Simpsons,
yay,
our weekly exploration of every episode of The Simpsons from the beginning. The entire first season is up there on patreon.com/lasertime. And I just put together a new post on there of just, I've been getting still a lot of messages from people saying, how do I find the first season? Because Patreon is not the best place to share audio. Mm-hmm. But I put together a new post for it to share with you guys. So take a look at it there if you're a new person. Also, I do K-Price's The Comic Book Podcast every week.
All right, and let's see, how about I plug Video Game Apocalypse, hosted by my husband, Michael, where they talk all video game stuff, and I'm not there because I don't know nothing about no video games. Mm-hmm. But I am on Twitter now, at ListenANerd, if you want some classic movie suggestions.
That's how I saw His Girl Friday.
Yeah, got right.
Oh, birthday.
Brings us to the end of the show. Birthdays this week.
Woo!
Who was born and who else aged 1 year? The following people: Anderson Cooper, Angelina Jolie, Russell Brand, Mark Wahlberg, Kenny G, Brian McKnight, Robert Englund, Paul Giamatti, Prince, Liam Neeson, Tom Jones, Michael Cera, Mick Foley, Bill Hader, Carl Urban, Kanye West, Jerry Stiller, Keenan Ivory Wayans, Nick Rhodes, Natalie Portman, Michael J. Fox. A lot of people born in June.
Wow.
Now for the quiz.
Okay.
Born in 1956, won Emmys for voice acting, was in Pitch Black, Platoon, The Thing.
Keith David?
Keith David.
Keith motherfucking David.
That's right, motherfuckers. 60. Keith David.
60 years
old. He ain't nobody for the Ghostbusters.
In the mid-90s, he was already winning
narrated
Emmys.
Narrated a bunch of Vince McMahon documentaries.
I fell in love with him as a kid with his voice of Goliath on Gargoyles. Like, that's amazing voice.
The Arbiter and Halo.
Yeah, that's how maybe you younger folks will know him.
And I mean,
Mass Effect,
Saints Row.
And the greatest on-screen fight of all time.
Yes,
They live,
everybody. We'll go out with Fine Invisible Touch, because that is a big album and it's a great song. Phil Collins and Genesis. When we come back next week, what happened more 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago?